Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
From Los Angeles, I'm Justin Savakis.
And I'm Zach Burchie. Welcome to AnCast. I got an action-packed week this week. We both just got back from the wedding of our buddies, Frank and Summer, out in New Jersey, so we're both a little tired.
Who knew that jet lag from 3 hours time difference would take such a toll?
I didn't quite have that problem, but I think you just get used to it, flying back and forth in New York and Los Angeles.
Yeah, I did it like once or twice a year, but I don't know. Yeah,
still got to.
Well, it's always worse going west.
Really? See, for me, I just love getting those 3 hours back so much that it's like I didn't spend the whole day flying.
my flights were a horrible time, so.
At any rate, so you did get around to reading something.
I did. Well, I had that whole plane ride there, so I grabbed a couple manga from my pile of cheap stuff that no one wanted from Meltdown Comics. Mm-hmm. And what I grabbed was the one-shot manga from Viz, Socrates and Love.
Now, they put some marketing dollars behind that when it came out.
I remember seeing banners everywhere, especially on our site, and so that piqued my interest, because, you know, I'm a sucker for a, you know, cute shoujo romance. Mm-hmm. And then I remember reading the review that just completely begged on it.
Right. Was that our review?
Yeah, that was our review. I don't really read any other manga reviews. I'm going to get shit for that one.
And with good cause.
Right. So I read it, and it is indeed horrible. It is absolute...
Well, what's the story?
Well, the story, I'd say a good 10% of the country's pop culture output, okay, is boy meets girl, boy falls in love with girl, they become couple, they have sex once, girl dies of cancer slowly.
The feel-good film of the year.
The thing is, this is a story that Japan just likes to drive into the ground. This story comes out either... It seeds very little anime form, but as far as manga, as far as novels, as far as TV dramas and movies, they can't get enough of this stupid formula.
Well, they just love to cry, right? It's a crime.
Yeah, more or less. And they're all the same.
Right.
The position of life changes, but the general story, almost identical. There's Kamisama Moskoshi Dake, which literally translates to "Please God, give me more time," which is a pop star and a girl and falls in love with a girl who's dying of AIDS. Mm-hmm. There is Crying Out Love in the Center of the World, which I think is another cancer one, and that got made into a TV series and a movie. It's just...
Which is weird, because they know the ending.
I know, and, you know, it's all about, you know, the long-lost love, and, you know, the, oh, I'll sprinkle your ashes wherever, and I recognize the kind of pulpy sincerity of it, but past a point, I mean, I just imagine the writer sitting there just lazily, almost half asleep, typing at full blast.
Well, so this stuff is basically emotional pornography, right?
It really is. Emotional. It is tragedy porn in the cleanest sense of the word.
But this is a cultural thing because you've told me this before, and I got a glimpse of it firsthand, that they just, as a society, sort of tend to focus on that kind of thing. Like, they just love to cry. It's a thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's something that, you know, even in kids' shows, like, you know, all the World Masterpiece Theater shows that ended in horrible tragedy and death. You know, all these little kids shows from, over the history of anime. And, you know, parents encourage their kids to watch it. They think, you know, empathy is an important trait to build.
Well, it is. Well, I got a glimpse of this firsthand because I went to see fucking Dragon Ball at the theater in Tokyo.
And that was a tragedy.
Speaking of tragedies. but there was a trailer for Marley and Me before the film.
Right.
And the American trailers for that, spoiler alert, the dog dies at the end of Marley and Me, okay? The American trailers for that did not focus on that. It was a cute little puppy with a ribbon, and right, they showed him and Owen Wilson bounding through the wheat and, you know, oh, mm-hmm, that precocious dog. The Japanese trailer was all the dog dying. It was all the dog on the hospital bed looking sad. Owen Wilson, you know, Marisan, no, you know.
No, it was dumb.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. So, I mean.
Yada!
Yeah. But the whole focus of the trailer was that. It was like, there was a sweeping scene of the dog running through and then automatically straight to the hospital. Like, just, they could have called it in Japan, "The Dog Dies." Because that's the... the whole trailer was like that, and I was like, wow, that is a really weird way to market that movie. Well, but I guess that's...
They like serious things. I mean, even the trailer for WALL-E, I'm not sure if you saw that on the American Blu-ray, but they completely eliminated all the comedy from that. From that trailer, it is nothing but the cute but somewhat desperate scenes, you know, on Earth early in the movie.
Right.
Which, frankly, yes, that was the best part of the movie.
Right.
But selling the movie like that is complete lie.
But I mean, but based on what you're telling me on this popular format, this popular formula, Marley and Me basically is one of those.
Yes, except yeah, bestiality version of Please God Give Me More Time.
Maybe not quite. Okay, so moving on. I got the Fullmetal Alchemist movie, The Conqueror of Shambhala, Blu-ray.
Right.
And I popped it in, and I realized I never finished that movie. I got about, a third of the way through it, and just never finished it for some reason. So I popped it in, and I watched the whole thing this time.
Mm-hmm.
And, what did you think of that movie?
Well, by the time I saw it, I was already a diehard fan of the show, so I probably would have given my left testicle just for, you know, anything more. Yeah.
Yeah.
You love those characters by the time you get to that point.
That's true.
Of the story. And, you know, I wonder if the lag between when you saw the show and the, you know, seeing it now might have affected that a little.
It's not a bad movie. And as a matter of fact, it's a great antidote to the Shonen Jump Naruto filler movie, the One Piece filler movie.
Right.
You know, something happens.
I thought they tried literally to do way too much.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I thought.
It suffers from what I call, oh my god, we're a movie now syndrome. And you can see this in a lot of stuff, even American things that start off as a long series and then they're a movie. And now that the staff has the budget and the time to do a movie, they spend way too much time on visual wankery, mm-hmm. like the dancing scene early on in the movie.
Yeah.
Yes, it's pretty. Yes, it's meticulously animated. No, it does not serve the story at all. Should have gone on the cutting room floor.
I think part of the reason I had a problem with it is I never liked the, oh, through the portal is the real world thing. I never really liked that. I thought mm-hmm. it was kind of lame. It's not really where I wanted the story to go. Like I would have better ideas, but I'm just saying I didn't really care for it. And the fact that the movie went the most obvious possible direction, Hitler is the villain, give me a fucking break, that just seems super lazy to me. Like, that's the most obvious thing they could have done, and I didn't care for the, oh, hello there, I'm Fritz Lang. Like, that just,
yeah,
I wasn't
was
cool. The weird, like, the wacky adventures of Edward Elric and Fritz Lang. It's like, this is retarded. Like,
And I'm a Fritz Lang fan.
Yeah, me too. But he needs to not be in my Full Metal Alchemist movie.
Yeah, he needs to go off and make Metropolis.
Yeah, the animation's really nice, and I did enjoy seeing those characters again. But I think you pretty much hit the nail on the head. It tries way too much. I really didn't appreciate the Nazis invade the world of Full Metal Alchemist bad guys.
Well,
and, yeah.
I have two thoughts on that. First of all, I was greatly relieved to see that coming from Sho Aikawa,
mm-hmm.
who, after Angel Cup, I really thought was probably, you know,
probably a Nazi.
You know, had Hitler flavored pom poms.
Yeah. Well, they spend a lot of time talking about Jews in this movie. There's a fair amount of time spent on Jews in Full Metal Alchemist.
Yeah, that's
movie.
True.
I was a little off-put by it, actually.
Sho Aikawa, if you're not familiar, he wrote Angel Cop, and the point of Angel Cop was that the corrupt Japanese government had sold Hokkaido to the Jews so it could become a garbage dump for the world's nuclear waste.
Okay, so we know what this guy's sensibilities are.
Yeah, he's a nut job. And, you know, when someone's talented and you actually admire their work, you're always there's a little voice in the back of your head going, oh, I wish they weren't crazy.
I'm kind of like that with Mel Gibson. I think he's a great filmmaker and he's made some amazing movies. It's too bad he's an anti-Semite.
Right.
You know, like, there's always going to be that in the back of my head, like, man, Apocalypto was a great movie, but it's too bad about Mel Gibson, you know?
Right, right. And, you know, so in the behind-the-scenes thing on the DVD I watched years ago, they actually said that they had to cut out about half of Sho Aikawa's script for this, which explains a lot.
Well, not only that, but Jesus, what, it would have been 3-4 hours long?
Well, basically, he got way too excited and when he found out there was going to be a movie, and he turned in, like, 180 pages.
And they clearly didn't have the budget for it.
Right. It's like,
as it is, the movie's a little long.
It is. It overstays its welcome.
It was like three climaxes.
It's a little cookie cutter. Well, I think the climaxes are an extension of "Yay, we're a movie now" syndrome.
Oh, okay.
Because that happens a lot when animators get a huge budget. Have you noticed this?
Well, yeah. I mean,
like Steam Boy, for example.
Oh God! Please don't bring up Steam Boy. Not that I didn't appreciate it. I've just seen it. You didn't like it at all?
I thought it was mediocre.
It kind of was. The animation was nice. I appreciated the setting.
Yeah.
I just had to watch it like four times.
Oh.
For work. So
I wouldn't have watched it twice.
Yeah. Oh God. But the for some reason, like, I keep thinking to the Simpsons movie, which didn't have the story problem, but did have the suddenly let's overanimate everything kind of thing going on. But it was supposed to be a summer blockbuster, so there
Fair
you
enough.
Go. But yeah, no, this it way too much going on. And like I said, the minute the Nazis are the villain in your movie, you're being lazy.
Right. Now, I would go so far as to say the ending, the very, very ending, was not quite satisfying. But that was completely sated for me by that kid's OAV, that little short kid's OAV that just came out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, just having that little period on the last sentence really just like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I actually thought the ending was fine. I thought it was fine. I was afraid that they were going to do the thing where he nobly goes back to the real world and leaves everybody behind. But, I mean, the fact that they brought the brothers back together was good. I was fine with that. Yeah. But, yeah, I don't know. I guess... I was expecting less. I was expecting less. I wanted less from it, and it gave me too much.
Yeah.
And I think that's where my issue with that
they're
is.
They're pacing problems. And that's pretty much along the short of it. It's
exactly. But so this is a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And I had some problems with the image quality, but you just took a look at it.
Yeah, it's, you know, as a guy who's spent way, way, way too much of his time obsessing over compression, a lot of Japanese HD masters have kind of a weird banding problem. I think it's just part of the production workflow there. So there's a little bit of that in this. But overall, I thought it looked pretty darn good.
Oh, it does. It does look fine. It's just that opening scene with the guy, the crazy guy trying to kill
That coat has a banding problem.
Yeah, it's got
the rest of the movie doesn't.
It's got a banding problem. I don't like the way that sort of sheen of fog, it doesn't seem intentional, but it's like a sheen over the whole thing.
Yeah, that's actually part of the digital animation process.
I know, and it doesn't look good on high def. Like, it makes it look like it's not quite high definition.
They do that to soften it because it does, so it doesn't look too digital.
Yeah, well, I want it to be clear, goddammit.
Yeah, one thing that was weird, there's no film grain on this, which means that it probably came directly from the Japanese, you know, before they printed it to film. It didn't go to film and then back.
Right.
So, yeah, that had to all have been artificial.
Right. So, also, last week...
another movie you didn't...
That I,
see,
some reason,
some
never
reason.
Saw. Well, I know what happened. I figured out what happened.
Okay.
So everyone knows, this is Pat Labor 2. You mentioned it last week.
Right, as one of my orgasm movies.
Yeah, one of your all-time favorite films. Mm-hmm. And I saw the first Pat Labor. I saw the third Pat Labor. I never saw the second one. And it's because just when I was getting into anime, like around 96, 97, that was one of the movies the old-timers at my anime club were shitting themselves over constantly.
Right.
And what happened was, when I first got sort of inducted into this anime club, and you sort of make friends with people, then you get taken over to someone's house, and they just have to show you certain things, like Akira, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
They were absolutely losing their minds over Bubblegum Crisis, and sat me down, and I didn't like Bubblegum Crisis. I thought it was kind of stupid.
It was pretty dated even back then.
Super 80s. Yeah, I was like, man, this is some old shit. Show me something good and new. And the guys explained Pat Labor 2 to me as, oh, it's like Bubblegum Crisis.
What?
Yeah. So that's what happened. That's why I
that
never saw it.
That is the worst description for that movie ever.
Now that I've seen it, that's the most retarded thing ever. And I think it's just because they both have robots in them. I don't know. Yeah. And Pat Labor 2 barely has robots in it. But I finally sat down and watched this. You loaned me your Blu-ray copy of it.
Right.
It's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
I'm shocked I've never seen it.
I think it's possibly Oshii's best film.
It's going to take a few more viewings for me. I'll have to get my own copy of it. Mm-hmm. But
that's an import, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I was there when you bought it, I think.
Oh, yeah.
we've got that
I,
here
I,
in
I
Japan.
I was peeing my pants.
Yeah. but it's really, really good. And actually, I wanted to quote this because it was a perfect way to sum up that movie. Todd Siolik, our video games guy, over Twitter when I mentioned we were going to, or I was watching it last night, and he said, and I quote, "Oh, hey, Pat Labor 2, the only political anime that doesn't piss its pants in front of the whole school assembly." Which, kudos, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, it really is.
It is. It's serious and sincere and smart. And it's, I mean, I think watching it now in 2009, it's a little diluted for me. Because all I could think of was, hey, this is kind of the plot of The Dark Knight. A little bit.
I didn't get that.
Guy with a point to make starts creating terrorist attacks to cause confusion and chaos and to prove a point.
Right. It's got a lot more similar to the politics of that, though.
It does, but I'm just saying there is a similar thread you could draw between the two. He's trying to make this grand point, and so is the Joker. Right. But that's all that aside. What I really liked about it were the long, slow scenes with that electronic score, where it's just like panning past industrial landscapes.
Oh, God, and some of those are just mind-blowing.
Yeah, they're gorgeous. They're gorgeous, and you just kind of sit there and sit in it, and it's great stuff. I mean, I can't believe I'm so late to the party on this, but it's an amazing
film. It creates this really kind of pensive but yet on-edge mood that really, I mean, this is why I connected to it so strongly after 9/11, that just kind of uncertainty hanging in the air.
Yeah.
It captures just dead nuts perfectly. I mean,
I loved the shots of normal city life with the soldiers and the tanks.
Yeah.
That's brilliant
stuff. I mean, you know, that's something I could relate to directly.
Yeah.
Literally, right. you walk into Penn Station, you pass a guy with an AK-47.
And, right. And the full fatigue and everything.
Yeah. And, you know, there are B-52 bombers in the sky.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, even recently, the whole idea of you know, a society in decline and having deserved it in some way for,
right,
you know, living too high while everyone else is suffering. I mean, those are conversations we're having today,
yeah,
right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole war is peace and peace is war thing, that's an old trope.
Well,
I mean,
sure. But for me, the very idea of power going corrupt simply because it was allowed to go out of control,
mm-hmm,
and transposing that in what looks like a peaceful society, you know, and everything is just completely under wraps and wrapped up in these layers of bureaucracy that completely betray how things actually are.
Mm-hmm.
That was, seeing that acted out in Pat Labor 2 is really something of a revelation for me. I never really thought of modern society like that before.
As sort of an illusion.
Yeah.
Where you're living in a bubble and so is everybody else.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I gotta say, absolutely loved the early 90s theatrical anime aesthetic. The backgrounds, there was a time when the backgrounds just looked like that.
Yeah.
In a theatrical film. Haven't seen it since. There is no other period, I think, that has that kind of background art, that style, that color, the saturation, even the line density. It's so specific to that era. Love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It reminds me of all the great stuff I loved in the 90s.
Yeah, totally. Know? And I think if there's any big tragedy to where anime is currently, apparently a lot of those background artists have retired.
I'm sure.
I'm still working on the interview, the studio tour we did at Satellite. And one of the things they were telling us on this tour is that there's a huge shortage of background, really good background artists in Japan.
Yeah, and you can tell.
Yeah.
Because most modern anime, the backgrounds are kind of shit.
Right. And, you know, because it was really all this old school thing where it was like these old guys with their watercolors literally doing it on paper.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen anymore. So, hey, if you're an aspiring artist and you want to be in anime, there's your major. Do landscapes.
Right. Okay, well, so we're in agreement on that. If you have not seen that movie, please go check it out. It's totally worth your time. Why don't we bring the guests in?
All right.
My. Oh, howdy, partner. Time for timer. Do you ever get that hungry feeling after school? Boy, I do. I'm so hungry, I could eat a wagon wheel.
When I'm slow on the draw and I need something to chaw, I hanker for a hunk of cheese. When my 10-gallon hats are feeling 5 gallons flat, I got something planned, which is little cheese sandwiches. Come on! Here's a great little snack to tide you over till dinner. If you want something delicious and nutritious, cheese is a super snack. Look, a wagon wheel. When my get up and go has got up and went, I hanker for a hunk of cheese. When I'm dancing a hoe down and my boots kind of slow down, or any time I'm weak in the knees, I hanker for a hunk of, a slab or slice of chunk of, a snacker D is a winner, and yet won't spoil my dinner. I hanker for a hunk of cheese. Yahoo!
Okay, and we're back. Our guest this week scarcely need much of an introduction. You know him as Sasuke and Naruto Shippuden and roughly 1 billion other roles. Yuri Lowenthal and his wife, fellow voice actress, also has been in about a million things, Tara Platt. Thanks for being on the show, guys.
Thank you guys so much. We're really glad to get to talk to you.
Yeah, so you're here to plug a book. So please, let's get that out of the way. what's your book? What's it about?
You got it. It's called Voiceover, Voice Actor, What It's Like Behind the Mic. And we wrote it together, and it's about sort of our life in the voice acting business, how we do what we do, how we got to where we're at right now, and a lot of ways that we think that anybody who wanted to get into the business could also employ some of the things that we did to get there as well. We've got a lot of, you know, we would get a lot of emails from people, you know, saying, hey, you know, I'm in high school. I love anime. I'd love to be a voice actor someday.
You and everybody else gets those. Everybody right. gets those.
We get those.
Exactly. Everybody gets those. My mom gets those. So we would, in the beginning, when we would get one, you know, once in a blue moon, we would do our best to, you know, write out as many things as we could think of and, you know, get back to them.
Which sooner or later became a form letter, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yes and no. I mean, we tried to. I mean, I think that both Yuri and I really tried to answer whatever the specific questions are. You know, like, you know, I'm in high school, and so we would say, oh, well, if you're in high school, try to get into your high school's drama, you know, program or whatever. We would try to cater to whoever we were responding to.
Right.
But it did get to a point where it was just like too many. We were getting too many hits, kind of in a way.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, but that was sort of the birth of the idea of the book. We're like, wow, if this many people want to know, and if, you know, we want to, you know, get back to those people, maybe the easiest thing would be just to write a book so that the next person who asked,
you can point them to a book, make some money, and never have to respond again.
Oh! No, dude, I love the fans too much to never ever respond again. But it certainly makes life easier because we also, you know, get the same questions from other actor friends of ours, you know, people who do a lot of mostly on camera or whatever. They're like, how do I get into voiceover? And that entails us, you know, having to schedule, you know, a lunchtime with those people and, you know, talk about all that stuff, which we'll still probably do, but it's nicer to be able to point somebody towards a book.
And also with the book, I mean, what I think is particularly fun is it's not just our own experience, which it does have a lot of that, but it also has anecdotes from 20 other, you know, VO professionals. In the book, it's got their perspective and their stories, and you get to hear their voice as well. And we also have like warm-up exercises and practice copy and all sorts of fun stuff in the book that sort of really rounds it out to not only give you our perspective and show you what our life as voice actors is like, but also to let you know if you're interested, these are some things that you might want to try or do or practice and what other people have to say. And so... So I think it's really fun.
So it's kind of a memoir / guidebook.
Yeah, it's more. I'd say it's more guidebook than memoir.
Okay.
Whenever something's appropriate, we'll you know, when we've got a story to tell, we'll do that. And it's like Tara said, there, you know, a lot of other people weigh in on voice acting in there, from, you know, directors to engineers and
lots of voice actors like Vic Mignogna, Liam O'Brien.
Yeah, Stephanie Shea.
Vic Mignogna.
Yeah.
Vic Mignogna.
All right. So I got to ask this. Now, you've got this book out, and surely you are familiar with or have potentially participated in the stuff that Bang Zoom is doing, the adventures in voice acting stuff. What's different? What's different between your book and what they're doing?
That's a good question. I know I did do an interview for Adventures in Voice Acting, but I will be honest with you, I'm not as familiar with exactly, you know, what they're doing with that and where they're going to take that. I'm sure they're going to cover some of the same ground that we are. It's inevitable.
How much is your book?
The book is $19.95.
Okay, well, their classes are like $350, so
okay.
maybe there's the big difference.
we're cheap. And we've also got the website that we have all the information for the book on and where you can order it also has lots of other information. It takes you to a blog that we do on voice acting. You can sign up on Twitter for voiceover tips that we're putting out. So we try to keep a lot of the information, you know, available to people. Even if they don't buy the book, there's, you know, interesting stuff there for you to find. And you know, we try to update it with exercises and things as often as possible.
And we try to keep it very, like, open communication with the fans and, mm-hmm. and friends and people who are interested.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is that's voiceovervoiceactor.com is that website.
Okay, so I got to ask this. Now, there seems to be sort of a cottage industry that's building up around telling kids how to become voice actors. Mm-hmm. Obviously, BangZoom is making money at it. Now you're making money at it.
Yeah, Crispin, I think, is doing classes as well.
Crispin, does, mm-hmm. yeah, Crispin Freeman does classes as well. Now, for the casual observer, or perhaps the cynical observer, it seems like, especially for men, it's the same five dudes in every leading role. Yuri, you're one of them. And right. then our buddies, you know, Johnny Young, Bosch, Vic, Crispin, you know, it's the same five or six guys, Greg Ayers. Is this sort of misleading? It doesn't seem like there really is much work out there.
I would say it's not misleading because there actually is a cornucopia of work out there. Yes, you will start to hear the same people over and over again. But I really think that there is a lot of work available and there's a lot of sort of unsung voiceover work too, where it's not like celebrity voices doing such and such or people that are known doing such and such. There's a lot of work in the industry, whether it's doing, you know, cartoons and animation, whether it's Japanese anime or original animation. There's commercial work, there's promo work, there's narration work, there's industrial work, there's books on tape and narrate. There's so many different kinds of voiceover. And actually, we spent a lot of time with our book talking about that and how if you want to make a living at it, it's not about only doing one of those aspects. It's about really broadening the scope and going and figuring out your own voice and figuring out what you can possibly do with it to make yourself money so that it isn't just, you know, you're up against Yuri or Vic, or you know what I mean? Like, it's not limiting it. It's broadening the scope and it's letting you see what really is out there. But at the crux of it, at the very, when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of it, at the end of the day, it's about acting and it's about being a good actor. And that's something that whether you're a good actor or not, you may want to be a voice actor. But at the end of the day, if you're not a good actor, you're probably not going to cut it and you're not going to be able to succeed. So ultimately, you have to be a good actor. And so that's sort of what we go back to over and over again is acting first, then all the other stuff later. And so I think that if you are a good actor, you will find opportunities, you will find work, and you may rise up to the top, so you'll be one of the top six actors. Do you know what I mean?
Like, it's sort of like, here's how to become a voice actor, asterisk, unless you suck.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, like, at the
you
end
know
of
what?
The day...
Yeah, I mean, we'll finish
yeah,
up. And then...
I mean, yeah, I mean, like, it's the same thing, like, whether you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a veterinarian or whatever, like, here's how you do it. These are the classes and courses and ways that you need to go about doing things to get there. But at the end of the day, unless you suck, you know what I mean? Like, that's sort of an inherent clause with any occupation, with any profession.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to say that I know some people who suck who still stay in the business because
me too. They're good.
I'm going to be honest with you, because you were honest with me. I'm going to be honest with you, but they know how to create relationships. They know how to be professional, and they're not necessarily, you know, those top five, six people, or you know, the most talented actor in the world. But that's something we also talk about in the book. Is you can have a really cool voice, you can be a great actor, but there's a lot to making a career in this. As a matter of fact, in the very first page of the book, we're like, okay, look. Here's the deal. You can read this book and never make it. It takes a lot of work. You know, we work really hard. We know the people who do stay on top also work really hard. But there is, as Tara said, a lot of work out there. It's not just, I mean, don't get me wrong. I love that it appears that you know, me and Johnny and Vic and Crispin and Troy, you know, whoever those people on top, that we, you know, that we do everything. I wish we did. But the fact of the matter is, you know, we may get some of those lead roles, but then, you know, those are never the only people, you know, on the show or on the game or, you know, in the project. I mean, there are lots and lots of other people who work.
And even if you are one of those people that are booking a lot, you're still probably only booking about 5 to 10% of everything you audition for.
Right.
So, I mean, like, even if you were to look at a career of an actor that you really admire, there's still how many, you know, count up the number of jobs they have and then multiply it. You know, like, because they're only getting about 10% or 5%.
But at the same time, the guy who consistently gets boy number two in episode 3 of some horrible show, he's not going to make a living doing that. I mean, this is all you're basically moonlighting, right? I mean, you can't make a living being a bit player as a voice actor.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if you're a bit player on a lot of different things, working for a lot of different places, mm-hmm. you very well could earn a nice little living. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's sort of ironic. Like, okay, so you look at Yuri, and Yuri plays Sasuke on Naruto, right? So you mm-hmm. go, oh, wow, Sasuke, he's one of the major three characters, right? When it comes down to the end of the day, Yuri goes in for less sessions on Naruto than I go in for. And I play Temari, and she's one of the sort of secondary characters. Now, she's not a red shirt character. She definitely has a role and a name and an arc to her story. But at the end of the day, just because he's a lead character doesn't mean he has more sessions than I have.
Well, not to mention, you know, whole arcs go by without Sasuke.
Right. Well, there's that too, yeah, and barrels and whatnot. But do you know what I mean? Like, so it's very sort of misleading to go, oh, well, if you're a lead, then you're going to be fine, and if you're not a lead, you're not. There's a lot of work out there, and you may have a great relationship, and they bring you in every episode to do Walla and incidental auxiliary characters, and so you've got a nice set job every week, you know, and it's quite possible you can make a living.
Plus, there's SAG union minimums.
Sorry, yeah. Oh, yeah, well, there are different kinds of union minimums.
Ah.
There's the union minimum that, for example, we get when we work on prelay American shows, like non-dub shows, like your Legion of Superheroes or your Ben 10. And then there's the dubbing rate minimum, which, well, you know, it's better than digging ditches as far as...
Is it?
Yeah.
Depends on the show, I'd say.
Yeah. But compared to, you know, a lot of the other stuff, is a substantially lower rate, despite the fact that you're working harder when you do a dub show. I mean, that work is harder, but you get paid less.
Right.
But in the end, you have to do, I think, to survive as a voice actor, any kind of actor, you need to broaden your scope as much as possible. Like Tara said, you know, we do animation, video games, porn dubbing, commercial stuff.
Wait, did you just say porn dubbing?
Porn, yeah, we both do a lot of porn dubbing. No,
maybe I said that. Maybe I said,
he said foreign dubbing.
Oh. Maybe I said foreign porn dubbing. You don't know.
An interesting job. Do I want to put a Swedish inflection on this? So you guys are married, and you're both in the same career. Now I wanted to ask, there are big differences. I would assume there are differences between being a female voice actor and a male voice actor, and how much work you get, and how difficult it is to get roles. Is that true? And if so, can you, you know, give us a little insight on that?
I would play a little devil's advocate in the sense that, you know, there do tend to be more male roles. There do tend to be more male characters, and therefore men tend to have more job opportunities. That said, a lot of women play young male roles. So there are a lot of women that get to play men in the voiceover industry. And so that sort of evens the playing field out a little bit. It is different because, you know, I mean, like, I am not going to play the same kind of roles that Yuri's going to play. Now, that said, I actually have played a role in a video game that was a man, that was a warrior man in Dynasty Warriors. I play a man. Go figure, right? but
did they hire you by accident?
No. Ironically, they cast me for one of the female roles and one of the male roles. They liked my man voice.
Who knew? And because you can't tell because you're there and you can't see her, I just want to let you know, Tara is not, in fact, a man.
Oh, okay.
But so, I mean, it's different in the sense that we're not going to be playing the same roles at the end of the day. But I would say it's very much the same. I mean, Yuri and I do the same work in the sense that we read the script, we figure out what we're doing, we ask ourselves questions, we make choices. It's really acting, and it's just that we're playing a different character, but that would be different from role to role as well. For me, going in to do an ingenue versus playing a villain, it's going to be different work, but the same work as Yuri doing the same two things for himself in roles that he's appropriate for.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I would argue that for female roles in an anime dub, there is sort of a generic anime girl voice in English dubs. A lot of them tend to sound very similar. So I have to imagine that there is some hurdle for you that's differentiating yourself from the 12 other women auditioning for it that are basically doing a similar voice. I have to assume that based on what I've heard. Maybe that's...
Yes. Well, but also, I mean, like, you're listening to my voice, and my voice has a certain timbre and pitch. I don't tend to be the high anime voice. Like, that's not how I speak all the time. You know, like, that's
thank
not
God.
Me.
Yeah. Right, oh, please, yes,
interview over.
And so I very rarely actually get the lead female role in an anime. I play the villainess, or I play a warrior chick, or I play a different character. I don't tend to play the little titillated girl. That's not what I play. But I still enjoy the characters I'm playing because there's something in those characters that I'm right for that's a lot of fun for me to do. Now, I can't speak to being the lead of a series because I'm not. I mean, well, you could say, like, on Busa Rankin, I was Tokiko, which is sort of the lead of that series, but she's also, it's a different kind of series. Like, she's a really strong, dark character. So I'm not playing the high school giggle girl. Like, that's just not what I tend to get cast as. But that's okay for me. Like, I don't mind that. I try to differentiate myself by bringing what I have to the table.
High school giggle girl was the name of my band in high school.
Okay.
That is a lie.
So, Yuri, what kind of obstacles do you find yourself running into when you're out there auditioning for stuff? What's like the hardest thing for you to overcome? You ever worry about, you ever get typecast?
Yeah, I mean, you know, getting typecast is only a problem in so much that if you want to, do something different, it's hard. I have not encountered it as a problem because being typecast has led me to work a lot. You know, I'm perfectly happy for them to typecast me as long as they keep hiring me.
Right.
Yeah, being shown an action hero is probably the most lucrative role in anime.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And it's, you know, and it was fun. It's funny because when I was younger, before I really started doing this, I used to hate my voice because I was like, God, you sound like a little kid. You know, little did I know that one day that would, you know, become lucrative. But it's one of the great things about voice acting as opposed to, like, you know, theatrical or on-camera acting is there is a lot of room for you to do different things. And not only different things than you normally do, but different things than anybody had ever cast you as. You know, in on-camera stuff, I get cast as I look. I mean, there's really not a lot of wiggle room there. But doing voiceover, I've played so many different things that I would never have the opportunity to play, you know, if you can, you know, when you can see me, which is great. But as far as the hurdles are concerned, I don't consider typecasting a hurdle as long as the work is still there. As far as other hurdles go, it's just, yeah, there's just I would say the hardest part about doing what we do, and I think it applies to all acting, is that the job itself is often extremely fun and hardly work at all. But we're constantly, because we don't have like a contract, if we're not working for a company that has us on retainer, that pays us huge amounts of money just to be around and work when they want us to, we're constantly looking for the next job. And when I tell people who want to get into this business, you know, well, it seems like lots of fun. I'm like, yeah, you know what? It is lots of fun. Here's the hard part. You're always looking for work. You're always looking for your next job. If you hate going on job interviews, you have to get used to liking those, because going to auditions, you know, if you go to maybe like two or three, four, if you're lucky, you know, voiceover auditions, which would be, I guess, akin to a job interview every day. So, and it's not a regular lifestyle, and it does take a lot of energy, you know, commitment and work. And I think that's where the work comes in. I guess that's the hardest part.
So speaking of, you know, what's lucrative, I have heard tell from other voice actors that I know that one of the best gigs any voice actor can get is a lead or even a major supporting role in a BioWare role-playing game. Have you heard that? Is that true? They made, like, Mass Effect, Knights of the Old Republic. I heard that those are, like, super lucrative roles. And if not, what's the best kind of role you can get in anime in terms of getting a nice check?
Well, I mean, it certainly doesn't hurt to get one of those nice character roles in a video game that's going to have you come in for 20, 30, 50 sessions, because those are nice session rates, and you're making, you're cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching every time you go in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly not shabby at all, because that's great.
Yeah. I mean, video games can be, depending on the game, it can be hard on your voice. I'm sure in talking to other voice actors, you know, it comes up that, you know, video games, and and a lot of voiceover, especially anime, because there's so much fighting. I mean, you know, if you watch any show or play any video game, it's mostly about, you know, striking somebody with a sword, stabbing them with a knife, blowing them up, you know. And then on the other side,
you have life.
Just like life. I wish. And, you know, conversely, getting stabbed, electrocuted, set on fire, falling from great heights, we have to, you know, set all that stuff up for them, you know, for all the different eventualities in a game or a show. So some of those games, while they pay well, if you're not taking care of yourself, you're not taking care of your voice and you don't know how to use it correctly, you could do one of those jobs and get paid well that day, blow out your voice and not be able to work for a week or 2 weeks or more, you know, if you hurt yourself.
And that's not good.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, moving on here. Do you guys read your reviews when you have a show or a game out? Do you ever read your reviews?
Sometimes. I mean, you know, sometimes people send them to us or they link them to us or whatever.
And, you don't go looking for it? Are you being honest with me?
Yeah, I am, actually, because this sounds horrible, but I sometimes forget what I've worked on.
Mm.
So usually it's sent to me, and then I read them when they send them to me. And, you know, it's hurtful if people don't like what I did, but it's nice when people say nice things. But at the end of the day, either I did what I was asked to do by the directors and the producers, and I know that, you know, I gave them what they asked me to give them. Or I have my own feeling about the project, and either the review reflects how I was feeling when I went in to record, or it doesn't. And, you know, I hope that people like what I do more than they don't like what I do, but you also can't please everyone, and everyone has an opinion and a right to that opinion. And so, you know, it can be hurtful when people say mean things about you, or if they say, you know, they want you to die because you messed up the character they love so much, because, you know, that's a little, like, harsh. But at the same time, like, I understand they're very passionate about it and they feel very strongly, so.
Yeah, it's true. Sometimes we'll work on a project, you know, especially with video games or original animation, and then it doesn't come out for like a year or 2 years, and it's hard to keep track of it sometimes. I will occasionally go out and look just to see what's out there. And occasionally, like Tara said, it pops up or we get sent things. I love reading reviews. But I've learned that you can't pay too much attention to any one person's opinion, whether that's good or bad, you know, just because if it's good, great. And if it's bad, you know, I'll wallow for a minute in that and wonder why everybody hates me. And then I'll go, yeah, you know, one person's opinion, you know, right.
So, I mean, I gotta ask, has it ever occurred where you got particularly shitty reviews or whatever, for whatever reason, people didn't like the performance? Has it ever impacted your ability to get work? I can't imagine it would.
No,
I don't think so.
I don't think like a negative review. I mean, it's hard to know that stuff. You don't always see like a, you know, sort of a very clear cause and effect thing for any of that stuff. I don't think it has made, you know, getting work and, you know, made it more difficult to get work. I know that in some cases, positive fan response has gotten me work. Like when I was working on the Prince of Persia game, on the first game, Sands of Time, we had a blast and the game did well. And then in the second game, they hired somebody else to play the prince because they had changed the sort of the format and the feel of the game. And after that game came out, even though it was popular, a lot of people were like, hey, well, you know, we kind of like Yuri as a prince. Where's Yuri? Blah, blah, blah. And so I, in the third game, I got to come back.
Yeah, actually, Yuri, I think I've heard you say, wait, that's not how it happened, about 500 billion times.
I know, you know, even my friends hate hearing that.
Oh, no, that's not how it happened.
Yeah. But I owe that. I think my being in the third game, I owe that to the fans, purely and totally. Because if it had been, you know, a business decision or whatever, I don't know that they would have gone back to me, you know, because they had already, you know, taken me out, at, you know, with the second game. And if I hadn't gotten those good, you know, the positive fan response, I doubt that they would have asked me back for the
third
game.
Yeah, I know that there are times when the positive can definitely help you, but I'm not sure if the negative can harm you. It's sort of harder to see the ramifications of that.
Unless everybody comes down on you.
So that must be one of the most personally fulfilling and positive experiences, to literally be brought back to a franchise by popular demand. I mean, that's got to be huge.
Without a doubt. Although, you know, occasionally it'll be personal moments that are huge. Like somebody will say, you know, usually it happens right about the time when I'm like, why am I doing this? Shouldn't I be building hospitals in Africa or something? What am I doing with my life? And somebody, you know, at a convention will meet somebody and they'll say, you know, I was going through a really dark period in my life. And then somebody introduced me to this show that you were working on. And you were playing this character, and it seemed like exactly what I was going through in my life at the time. And I just want you to know that helped me somehow. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, oh God, you know.
So it's really no different from building hospitals in Africa or helping the sick and poor.
Exactly.
Right. Dubbing anime is philanthropic work.
Yeah,
exactly.
all of the 12-year-olds whose families were murdered and are out to kill their brother have someone to relate to now.
Right.
Exactly.
Yes.
Luckily, I don't get blamed for when things go wrong like that.
or poor girls who have to deal with homunculi. You know, it's the same thing.
Right.
Right. So I got to ask about this, and Justin and I have very strong opinions on it. Voice actor commentary tracks on Region 1 DVDs. How do you guys, have you guys ever done one of those? How do you feel about those?
Yes, I've done one. You've done one too, haven't you?
I don't know that anybody's asked. I mean, they've occasionally included outtakes, sometimes without our knowledge, which can be terrifying. But I don't know that I've gotten
you
to
do. You haven't done
a
commentary track? I know that I've done commentary tracks. I don't know. I mean,
what did you do one on, Tara?
I did one as Tokiko, well, as myself, for Busarenkin. And I think they had me in for another show to do a commentary track, and I can't think of what it is off the top of my head. But you know, if fans enjoy that and they like listening to it, great, but I don't really understand why. I didn't create the show. I didn't design it. I don't know enough about it because I won't get a chance to watch the show till it airs. So I sort of feel like right. I can comment on, I have to scream really loud now or stuff like that. But I don't know that my commentary as an actor is knowledgeable enough to be commentary for something like that. I mean, I sort of feel silly because a lot of times they say, well, can you say this now? And I'm like, I feel like I'm acting like myself. I'm not being myself. So it sort of sometimes can be a little weird.
I'd love to do, I mean, I love commentary tracks on regular, like, theatrical DVDs. And I'd love to do more of that stuff because, A, I was a huge fan of Mystery Science Theater 3000, and B, because, you know, when you get a really good commentary track, in my opinion, it's huge. It's great. Like, the commentary track for John Carpenter's The Thing, and it's John Carpenter and Kurt Russell, and they've obviously, you know, been drinking for about 3 hours. And it was hugely entertaining for me. Like, I'll go back and listen to that again, even though I've heard it. I wish people would ask me to do commentary tracks.
I'll let you do mine the next time.
Okay,
because Tara, I'm glad you answered that way with a little uncertainty, because my next question is, do you think the guy that dubbed The Godfather into Spanish should get his own commentary track on The Godfather DVD? you feel the same way I do on this.
Yeah, well, honestly, the Japanese ones are a million times worse.
Yeah, they are. Oh, they're much worse.
Yeah. God, I've had to subtitle those and I've wanted to put a gun in my mouth. Now, that's the thing. I mean, usually the voice actor doesn't get to even see the show until they're in the booth, and, you know, oftentimes they're not given enough direction at all to really know much about the character.
Right.
So, briefly, Yuri, you said you were an MST fan. Do you have a favorite episode?
I think Manos, Hands of Fate.
Yeah, everyone says Manos. Werewolf is the best episode.
Werewolf is your favorite?
Absolutely. Have you seen that?
Trying to remember Werewolf.
You have to see it. If you haven't seen it, it's out on DVD. It's phenomenal.
Well, then I will.
Okay, moving on here. Now, you both are not just voice actors. You're both involved in some independent filmmaking. As I was doing my research, Reed plugging your names into IMDb, I noticed, Yuri, you wrote and this film called Tumbling After that got produced, and you and Terry, you're both in the film. Briefly, just, you know, give us a little background. How did that happen? Is there a place people can see this movie? Do you want people to see this movie?
Ultimately, we will want people to see it. It's not available for mass consumption yet. We've just completed it, and it's doing the festival circuit right now. We actually just won an award at the Accolade Film Festival. We won an award for merit, which is it's not released yet to DVD or anything. We're actually going to be in talks with some distributors. And we've started some talks with distributors to see if we can get a DVD release of it. So ultimately, yes, hopefully people will be able to watch it. And yes, we would like people to watch it.
Yeah.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It came about in that, you know, going back to, you know, how you always have to be busting your ass to, to really be, you know, always be working in this business. As actors, you really only get to work when somebody else says you can work. Like, there's very little control as an actor unless you start to take control by writing and producing your own projects. And that's sort of where this film came from and where our production company came from. For when people aren't hiring us or hiring us to play the kinds of roles that we want to play, we can, you know, put energy into producing our own things. And this film came about in that way. We were actually in pre-production on another film, another script that we were working on, and this location became available sort of out of the blue, and we would only have it for a limited period of time. And so we said, we gotta make a film there. But we only have, you know, until the location's not available anymore, we have 3.5 weeks from right now. So we wrote a script and cast people and hired people and shot for 2 weeks. So by at the end of that 3.5 weeks, we had shot a feature film. Now, it took 2-3 years after that to finally get the film all done with, you know, with all the various sort of stages of post-production you need to make a film watchable. And when you don't have, you know, millions of studio dollars to throw at a film to make all that stuff happen, you have to call in a lot of favors and it takes time instead. But that's what happened with this project, and we finally finished it. And yeah, it's not our dream project. Like, this is exactly the thing we want to be remembered for the rest of our lives. But we're proud of it, and yeah, we do hope that someday people get to see it. It's a psychological thriller. So
it's creepy. It's not going to be for everybody. Yuri's crazy, so the story is weird.
That's cool. Yeah, we'll link to the site. I know there's a trailer out there.
A cool trailer.
We'll link to it. The other thing I absolutely have to ask about, because I noticed this in your IMDb profile, and this movie is a little notorious already in and around the industry and sort of the gossip circles, Stu Levy's live-action Van Von Hunter movie. So you're the lead in this thing, and I have to tell you, we are all dying to see it, and not for reasons you might think. Exactly the reason you might think. What the hell is going on with that movie?
I am glad that you asked this, especially just now, because we've been working on that film for 2 years, and it started out... I'll give you a little bit of background.
I still want to know what they're looking forward to. I want to know from them what they're...
Well, that'll be our question to you after I talk about it.
Go on ahead.
It started out as they were going to just shoot a very short couple of webisodes over a weekend to promote the Van Von Hunter manga. And I had worked with them, you know, doing voiceover stuff, and they asked if I would do this, and I said, sure. And so we shot a weekend's worth of stuff, and they came back, you know, they called me in a week, and they said, you know what, we got a lot of good stuff here. This was a lot of fun. We're thinking we may do, like, a feature film version of this. And I'm like, I have no idea what that entails, but, you know, sure, call me. I'm happy to, I liked playing this guy, so let me know. And over the next 2 years, they would write more stuff, and we'd shoot it, and they'd write more stuff, and we'd shoot it, to the point where then we were going to New York to shoot stuff, and then we went to Tokyo to shoot stuff, and I'm like, but at every step of the way, I was like, I don't know, you know, it's developing at such a weird rate that
it piecemeal without a complete script?
Correct.
Oh, yes.
Because it kept changing, and they would have new ideas, and they'd write other stuff. And so, I mean, I think this will definitely be a film where the bonus material, the deleted scenes, will, you know, it'll be like 6 hours of bonus material and deleted scenes, you know, for an hour and a half movie.
Be like Anchorman. You can make a whole new movie from it.
Right. Exactly. And it's sort of amazing. Now, the reason why it's great that you just recently asked is that was about all I could say about it until last week when I actually got to see the final cut.
Oh, really?
They finally screened it for cast and crew. And I was, honestly, I did not know what to expect going into it. I was a little nervous. Okay, I was a lot nervous.
He was a lot nervous.
I was fucking terrified.
Yeah.
But we got there, and they really put together something cool. The movie itself is cool. I think the audience, the final audience for the fans is going to be, you know, the final audience is going to be fans. It's going to be fans of anime and Japanese culture.
And the Japanese.
And I think Japanese people really dig this film. It's weird.
It's weird.
It's a weird film, but it's fun. And you will get to see me make an ass of myself. If that's the reason you were waiting to see it, well, you will not be disappointed.
No, that's not it. the film has a reputation already because the going notion is that Stu Levy has sort of lost his mind over the last 5 years. And people are really curious to see what exactly it is he's doing with this.
Well, then I can't wait for you to see it.
I have some friends at William Morris. I heard some stories.
Yeah. Oh, no, he's crazy. He's certifiably crazy. And I think that the movie will reflect that, but hopefully in a good way. I mean, now that I've seen it, I can't wait for people to see it and get their reactions. See, I'm a lot prouder of it than I thought I would be, because it was hard through the process, even knowing if we were getting anything we could put a movie together with. And they put a lot of work into it.
Well,
and,
now here's a question. This begs the question. The manga is a totally straightforward fantasy parody thing. There's nothing surreal about it. It's actually, no offense, it's fairly generic material. How did he come up with something that's super piecemeal, surreal, shot in multiple locations in New York and Tokyo out of a fantasy parody?
Well, here's sort of the story. That the basic plot is that Stu and Stu Levy and Stephen Calcote play these two directors who are
he's in it?
Of course he's in it, Justin. Of course.
Stu is in it, essentially playing himself. And they play these two directors who are going to be shooting a movie version of this manga. I mean, there's a lot of sort of reality stepping on fiction, but they're going to shoot a movie version of this manga, Van Von Hunter. And so they hold a casting call, and the real Van Von Hunter shows up. And they freak out, A, because they thought that the two guys who wrote the manga just made all that stuff up. But it turns out there's a real guy. Unfortunately, he sucks and they don't want to hire him to even play himself. But then in the end, he's the only guy for the role. Nobody else will take the role. And so they end up hiring him. But he is sort of this fantasy character who's found his way into the real world and has to deal with real world stuff.
And that's part of what's so fun about the movie, is you're really going on this journey with the character of Van Von Hunter.
Yeah, it's very sort of, a lot of it's very documentary style, as if, you know, this were actually going on. It's something else, man. It takes all sorts of crazy turns.
Well, we're definitely looking forward to seeing the final product. Forgive our skepticism, but it's just...
No, please go right ahead. I'm skeptical of most things.
Okay, so we gotta finish up here. I wanted to get this last thing in. You guys are voice actors. You go to conventions. You do countless interviews all year long. Is there a question you wish people would quit asking you?
Like
you're tired of answering it. I would imagine, how do I become a voice actor would be one of them.
Well, yeah, but we solved that one by writing a book, so we can just tell them to go get the book.
Now you can point to a link.
but yeah, that's when we get a lot. Mm-hmm. We also, I think, especially
at conventions. At conventions, we're asked to say lines over and over and over again, and that gets a little tiring. Just because people come up and, like, literally you'll have, you know, 100 people in line and every single person wants you to say something.
So dance, monkey! Dance
exactly.
For me!
Right, exactly.
There's a lot of dance, monkey, dance going on.
Yeah, and it's hard because on one hand, I mean, I used to be that dude standing in line because I used to go to a lot of conventions, you know, growing up. And so I totally get where they're coming from. But it's hard on our side to not feel like dance, monkey, dance.
Doesn't make it less annoying.
Yeah. And for a lot of times, it's not even lines that that any of our characters would normally do. It's some, you know, weird yaoi thing that they want me to yell, or some weird inside joke, you know, that I'll never get, but, you know, now that they've got it on video and they can put it up on YouTube, all their friends will get it.
How many times have you been asked to say it's over 9,000?
You know what? I was asked in an interview last week for CoinOp TV to actually say that. It was the first time that I think anybody asked me to say it where I actually understood it and where they actually got it on tape. And it came out actually pretty funny.
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
But yeah, it's stuff like that. We get it all the time. And now because of YouTube, you know, everybody's got their camera and they're they're taking everything down. You don't want to be mean and say, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, put your camera away. Because we love, you know, we love that the fans would even show up to a convention to see us. So we're happy to do that stuff. But yeah, it can get...
But you can get tired after a whole weekend of doing a con by the end of the last day, and you're just, like, wiped out, and people just want you to perform, and you're just like,
oh, yeah.
Can I just say hello to you and meet you instead?
Right. No, we're exhausted. At the end of a weekend con, we're beat, because you're on for, you know, all of your waking hours you spend performing.
Okay, well, so the book is Voiceover Voice Actor, What It's Like Behind the Mic, and you can go to voiceovervoiceactor.com.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Congratulations on the book, guys. When's it out? Next week?
Thank you. Actually, it came off the printing press like a week and a half ago. We're having our book launch party this Friday night. For anyone in Hollywood, you guys included, at Meltdown Comics from 7 to 10 p.m. on Sunset Boulevard.
Cool.
We're having our book launch party.
This Friday the 13th, yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, congratulations on that. And real brief, we want to get some Twitter questions in from the fans.
Yeah.
Okay, so from Winsome Harry, are you upset that they cast Jake Gyllenhaal instead of you in the Prince of Persia movie?
Oh, Winsome Harry, you have no idea.
Yeah, I know how Hollywood works. I know there was no way that I could have, you know, been cast as the prince in Prince of Persia. But I've seen the trailer, and it's kind of awesome, Yeah, you know, I tried to get in on some little role. I talked to the casting people. I was like, okay, you got to do this for the fans. You got to do this for me. You know, even if I'm just some dude that Jake punches in the face as he's running by, you know, it'd be like an inside joke. But they were shooting in Morocco with mostly British cast, and my pleas fell on deaf ears.
Well, it's Jerry Bruckheimer. What do you want?
right. Yeah, no, I never got a chance to talk to Jerry, strangely enough. But I don't know. The trailer looks really cool. I would have loved to have played a part in it, just because I love that the mythos and the story and the game and the character so much that I would have loved to have been a part of that part. But I got to be a part of it at the beginning, so that's something.
Well, you may have dodged a bullet because Ben Kingsley's in it, and he's never a good sign these days. Okay, from Vicious Smith. If we want to hear both of you in a cartoon, what's the number one title you can point to?
Vicious Smith, I would go watch Naruto.
I think, was it Mrs. Smith or Vicious?
Oh,
Vicious.
I thought it was Vicious.
No, it's Vicious. Oh, Vicious.
Okay, like, you were right. Right, okay.
I would go watch Naruto.
And maybe Rave Master, because I think they're showing that on
Sci-Fi.
On Sci-Fi. On Sci-Fi.
On Sci-Fi.
Rave Master, yeah, it was our first show that we got to do together, and I play a hero and she plays a villainess, and we fight on it. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Okay, similar sort of question from Sidamine's lover, who just got permanent banned from our forums.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a favorite. Yuri, what's your favorite role that you did with Michelle Ruff? Rave Master, Blue Dragon, Gurren Lagann, Code GS, or Girls Bravo?
That's a tough question. And congratulations on getting banned. You must be a badass if you got banned from the forum. I would say Gurren Lagann was one of my favorites. I think that I've done with her or really anyone. I love that show. But I have a special heart. I have a special place in my heart for Girls Bravo, because as much as it's just sort of a fan service show, we took a lot of care with it, and it was really funny. And Tara was actually on some episodes of Girls Bravo as well. I forget who you were on there. You jumped in and out for a few things. You were in the body switching episode,
yeah.
Which of course every series has to have at one point or another. But there's something really kind of sweet and really funny about Girls Bravo, and I think it gets overlooked a lot because it is, you know, basically boobies. yeah, that I'd say that and Gurren Lagann. As much as I love Code Geass as well, if I had to pick two, and if I had to pick one, it'd be Gurren Lagann. Sorry, long answer.
That's okay. That's totally fine. Okay, from Salvador Asciencio. Probably saying that wrong. First, are you planning to send one of your reviewers to Japan to watch and report on the premiere of the Disappearance of Haruhi Suzumiya movie that comes out next February? Now that I found out it's confirmed to be a 150-minute feature, I would imagine this is one anime movie lots of people are going to be very anxious about. Right now, I am actually on the prowl for an English-speaking good writer who lives in Japan and can go see these movies. If that's you, so please send me your resume. I'm definitely looking for one. That is a movie we will absolutely be covering from every angle if we can. So I hope so. I hope we have somebody over there for that.
God, that'd be nice.
Yeah, 150 minutes.
That's.
I bet you there's some kind of bullshit in it where there's like 30 minutes of the same scene repeating over and over. I bet you that's in it.
The last anime that was that long was one of the, I think it was one of the Yamato movies.
God. Yeah, but you know there's going to be some bullshit in there. It's going to be some like, here's a 20-minute sequence that's just, you know, Haruhi Suzumiya staring straight into the camera.
My favorite part about the whole Haruhi Suzumiya thing is that even though every fan has by now figured out that they're being completely and utterly fucked with, they'll all still go see it.
Yeah. They'll complain about it nonstop.
Oh, yeah, but they'll see it.
They'll see it anyway.
And they'll probably buy the DVD.
Okay, second, about simulcast dubs. Mm-hmm. I know Bandai did this with Kurokami, which I guess ended up with rather lukewarm response, but is it possible for Japanese production committees to include English simulcast dubs in their budgets? This is especially for surefire hit series, like, for example, a second season of Bakemonogatari. Surefire hit. A new KyoAni series, or a new Shinbo Shaft series. If the Japanese otaku are willing to pay the high prices for DVDs and Blu-rays that make a series a best-selling title, surely including an English dub production would nevertheless still make them earn those sales.
I love that he named nothing but shows that have not been released in America, and therefore we don't know how well they do.
Right. Bakemonogatari is not a surefire hit in America.
I haven't seen it.
But you know a lot about this.
Yeah. I was actually, full disclosure, I was actually involved a little bit with the Kurokami dub. I was doing the video formatting at the, you know, basically the last stage of the process. And it was it was the first time it had been done ever. And Japan turns in stuff so last minute that it was a challenge for almost everybody involved. It was really, really hard. I think Mike Center Necklace, who was directing, probably lost a good year or two off his life. I don't see this happening on a regular basis just because it's such a logistical pain. And honestly, nobody knows if it's worth the investment. Kurokami got a lukewarm response, but that's just because people weren't so hot on the show. I'm not sure how much that had to do with the dub. But it's really hard work, and they're still figuring out the best way to do it, and nobody knows if it's worth it. So I guess my answer is a big old shrug.
Okay, we got two from Chris O'Connell. Thanks for these questions. The first one's a little too long, and we're running over time here, so I'm just going to skip to the second one. Is it so hard to find someone who speaks English fluently in Japan? All the English in anime, from online signs to from on-screen signs to names and dialogue, gets ridiculous. Do the Japanese production companies think what they're putting out is correct, don't care, don't have the time budget to check, or prefer it as it is? It can be embarrassing trying to introduce someone new to anime and have to excuse the horrible English.
Japanese studios have almost nobody that speaks English, and in fact, several anime companies I know don't have anybody that speaks English at all. On rare occasion, I'll have someone that you know, speaks a little bit of English. A few of them, like Madhouse, have like one English speaker. It's pretty rare, and oftentimes even the people that are at the licensor approving the translation and everything don't speak English very well, so they'll like make corrections to the script that are obviously not correct English. Mm. Yeah, it is. They don't really care that much. They're stressed. They don't have time to check. They're starting to care. It is a little embarrassing for them, but most Japanese people don't really know how bad their English is, and well, we're not going to tell them.
Yeah, it's the last thing when you're trying to license something.
Right.
Okay, finally, from Paola Alberts. Sorry, I'm masquerading your last name, but you have the same name as an Anime News Nina character, so that's interesting. Animation is a worldwide medium that practically every country shares, but you rarely hear about animation that's not from North America or Japan. So I wanted to ask if any of you have watched any foreign animation projects that you really enjoyed and would recommend to anime fans or fans of animation in general. I assume she means from countries other than North America and
right.
Japan. There's one movie coming out that I am looking forward to seeing. I think it's called The Secret of Kells or something like that. I think I believe it's a French-Irish co-production.
France produces some amazing ones.
Yeah, France makes some pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah. Wasn't Waltz with Bashir a French co-pro?
Boy, I think so. Unfortunately, you know, we're a little uneducated on this.
I love British animation. I love British animation.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, I devour all forms of animation. I'm a cartoon nerd.
Yeah.
Just in general.
I have fond memories of going to the Detroit Institute of Arts with my parents to go see those animation festivals. Remember those?
Yeah.
Those mm-hmm. were great. I missed those, and actually I rented one or two of them and was sorely disappointed.
I would say, like, if you're having trouble finding a way to get exposed to this stuff, There are really nice DVDs out that are just compilations of nominated animated short, foreign animated shorts, nominated for Oscars. That's a great way to get exposed to artists you might want to follow, or studios you might want to follow, or anything. That's a really good way to get introduced to a lot of that stuff.
The first two animation shows, those are out on DVD. Those are great.
Yeah, it's tough to find exposure because a lot of European and foreign animation that's not Japanese or American doesn't really have mainstream appeal.
A lot of it's really arty.
Yeah, it's very arty. So that's why you tend to not see a lot of it. I should expose myself to a lot more than I currently do. But yeah, so absolutely.
For the record, Boy Who Wanted to Be a Bearer was good for nothing but that laugh right there.
All right, well, that's all the time we have. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will see you. Oh, actually, a quick announcement. Justin, you're off to Singapore.
I am out of the continent.
Yeah, so, Justin will be off for 2 weeks. And
yep, there'll be no buried treasure. There'll be no, I won't be on the podcast. I'll be but a guy overseas blogging.
If we can figure out a way to get you to do a remote segment from Singapore, we'll do it.
That'd be awesome. I have no idea what my schedule's like yet. Well, we'll see.
But next week, it'll be me and Bamboo and a guest to be announced. So see y'all next week.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for not being afraid to ask the tough questions.
Well, you guys were great sports. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're so welcome. Anytime.